Matsuo Fushida and his Test Me from Pearl Harbor to Calvary. Matsuo Fushida is best known for leading the devastating air attack on Pearl Harbor on the 7th of December 1941. After the war, Fushida became a Christian evangelist who conducted evangelistic outreaches throughout Japan, the United States, and Europe. Fushida was the son of the master of a primary school in Kashiwara. His grandfather was a samurai warrior. In many ways, he was a samurai warrior too, but in the air. Matsuo Fushida entered the Imperial Japanese Naval Academy in 1921. He graduated as a midshipman, 1924, promoted to ensign, 1925, sub-lieutenant, 1927. By the way, you notice these are all British naval designations and ranks. He specialized in horizontal bombing. He gained combat experience during the Sino, or Chinese-Japanese War, where he was assigned to the aircraft carrier Kaga in 1929. Promoted to lieutenant commander in 1936, he was accepted to Naval Staff College, which is where you train to go into higher ranks. He joined the aircraft carrier Akagai in 1939 as commander of the air group. By the way, he traveled to Europe and he observed some of the Battle of Britain. He flew in Messerschmitts and observed the differences between German Messerschmitts and British Spitfires and so on. He was made commander in October 1941 under the command of Vice Admiral Nagumo, with 6 aircraft carriers and 423 aircraft under him. Commander Fushida was responsible for the coordination of the aerial attack on the U.S. Pacific Fleet. Now, if you've seen Toya Toya Toya, or Tora Tora Tora, it's spelt us, but Japanese pronounce it Toya Toya Toya. These are the people who play, and in fact, the person concerned looks very much like Matsuo Fushida. And he was, by the way, an expert advisor on the film set for Toya Toya Toya. This is quite a phenomenal operation. Direct line from Japan to Honolulu, but they went way north and came down from the north. This was their target. The entire American Pacific Fleet bottled up in this turkey shoot. Now, these are some of the Japanese sketches. You can see how they're crossing out. Like, you know, 2 lines means damaged and 3 lines pretty serious. X, like, sunk, and so on. So these are obviously their different ways of trying understanding. And this is what he is circling the whole time during the battle. And these are his notes on the attack as the commander. He was in the first wave of 183 dive bombers, torpedo bombers, and level bombers and fighters, which took off from carriers 370 kilometers north of Ohio and targeted the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor. One of their bombers, these are pictures taken actually at the time of the attack by the Japanese. At 7:40 a.m. Hawaiian Standard Time, Fushida ordered Tenkai, take attack position. He slid back the canopy of the Nakajima Kate torpedo bomb and fired a green flare to signal attack. He then instructed his radio operator to send a coded signal, to, 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 strike. And this was the result. These are pictures taken actually at the attack. At 7:53, Fushida sent the code words Toya, Toya, Toya back to the carrier Akagai, the flagship, to report complete surprise had been achieved. Tora, or Toya in Japanese, was the acronym for Tusageki Rakageki, torpedo attack. In Japanese, the acronym Ta and Ra together, Tora, actually means tiger, and tiger achieves complete surprise. You may not see the tiger in the jungle, but he'll see you. First thing you'll know about is when he's got you. So tiger was using the acronym of torpedo attack, but to mean we've achieved complete surprise. When the attack on Pearl Harbor hit at 7:55 a.m., many American sailors or soldiers were on leave or sleeping late. That's Sunday morning. Why were they not in church, just for starters? I mean, I'm just wondering, what on earth is the case for these people? 7 battleships are lined up on Battleship Row. And here you can actually see, these are actual pictures taken by the Japanese during the attack. And you can see naming, identifying. And here's a Japanese aerial photograph of the Battleship Row under attack. And you can see the oil spreading out from torpedo attacks. And I mean, the billowing smoke, and you can just begin to imagine some of the horror going on underneath there. The Oklahoma capsized. The West Virginia and California were sunk. The Nevada was damaged. Beach near the mouth of Pearl Harbor. If it had sunk in the mouth, that would have been bottled up the whole fleet. Tennessee, Maryland, and Pennsylvania were damaged. 10 other ships were sunk or seriously damaged. The Arizona sank with over 1,000 sailors on board after a stupendous explosion of its forward magazine to one dive bomber. Bomb went straight through the deck into its magazine. That was the worst. Just 8 days later, the Americans had published a picture of this same ship, the Arizona, with the words, "It is significant that despite the claims of air enthusiasts, no battleship has yet been sunk by bombs." Might have been sunk by torpedoes, but not by bombs. And pride goes before a fall. It's like people saying, not even God could sink the Titanic. It's a pretty dumb comment to make. As the first wave returned to the carriers, Fashida remained over the target to assess damage to observe the second wave attack. He returned to his carrier only after the second wave had completed its mission. 21 large flak holes, that's from anti-aircraft guns, were found in his aircraft. The main control wires were barely holding together. It's incredible that he could have survived so many hits to his aircraft. He stayed over the combat zone the whole time of the attack during two waves. He actually shouldn't have made it back to the ship. 21 hits? How does a plane like that stay? I mean, have you seen them? These planes were mostly canvas and string and wire. The Japanese lost 29 aircraft in the attack on Pearl Harbor. The U.S. Pacific Fleet lost 21 ships, including almost every battleship, 188 aircraft destroyed, another 159 damaged, 2,403 lives lost. Absolute disaster in Pearl Harbor. And these are just some of the pictures of the devastation and destruction caused. In Fashida's memoirs, he remarks being upset by Admiral Nagumo cancelling the third wave attack, which could have destroyed Pearl Harbor's fuel tanks and dry dock facilities, which would be needed to repair their ships. I was upset and thought, what stupidity. But the decision belonged to the commander, and it would not do any good if I complained. Not in Japanese culture, you didn't complain. But the third wave was planned, and the third wave was cancelled. And if the third wave had gone on, it would have been even more catastrophic. Years later, Fashida said that while he mourned those who died aboard the USS Arizona and other ships, he didn't regret his role in the Pearl Harbor attack. "It was war," he said. And remember, Japan was fighting for their life against communist China. They were trying to prepare to protect themselves against the Soviet Union. And now America was forcing them into a situation where they were being strangled to death, that they couldn't defend themselves, and they sought need. They had to cripple the U.S. fleet so that they could take the oil and rubber that they needed in the Dutch, Indonesian areas and Malaya, and in this way be able to survive. They saw it as, well, we've been forced, that we've got no choice. So from his perspective, remember, he's not a Christian at this stage. He's a Shinto. He's from a Buddhist background. He worships the emperor. And he accepted the war culture. So his view was, well, we were at war, and we'd been provoked to war, and the Americans must have known we were going to attack, because what else were they provoking us for? And he was granted an audience with the emperor. Tremendous, I mean, what an honor in that culture. The emperor is considered a living god to the Shintos, and his word was law, and they were all sworn to die for the emperor anyway. And the emperor personally decorates him with great and the highest medal that he could receive. On the 19th of February 1942, Fashida led the first of two waves, 188 aircrafts, in air raid on Darwin, Australia. Any country that has a city named after Darwin kind of is asking for something. On the 5th of April, he led another series of air attacks against the Royal Navy bases in Ceylon. And here's actually a picture of Mitsuya Fashida landing in a B-5N2 bomber on board the Akagi, won the Indian Ocean during the attack on Ceylon, 5-9 April 1942. In June 1942, Fashida was recovering from an emergency shipboard appendicectomy. It had appendicitis. When he was wounded in the Battle of Midway. I mean, this was the key battle of the war on the Pacific. He was on the ship's bridge during the morning attacks by U.S. aircraft. As the Kagawa was hit, a chain reaction from burning fuel, live bombs began the destruction of the ship. An explosion threw him to deck. He broke his ankle. He's actually blown overboard and was in the sea, and he somehow survived. After recuperation, Fashida spent the rest of the war as a staff officer. 2 weeks before the American invasion of Guam, he was ordered to Tokyo. When the Japanese on Guam failed to repel the American invasion, Vice Admiral Kakuta and his staff chose seppuku, the samurai ritual suicide of disembowelment, which, if he's on there and his leader ordered it, then they would have all had to commit suicide. That was just, he wouldn't have had a choice. And he says, again, the sword of death had missed me only by inches. What did it mean? The day before the first atom bomb was dropped in Hiroshima, he was in that city, in Hiroshima, to attend a conference. And a long-distance call from naval headquarters required him to return to Tokyo. As he ate breakfast in Yamamoto, 200 kilometers away, he learned that everyone he'd been working with in Hiroshima had perished in the atomic explosion. The day of the atomic explosion, he was sent back to Hiroshima to assess the damage. I mean, nobody knew what an atomic bomb was. What was this? All the members of Fushida's party died of radiation. But Fushida exhibited no symptoms, never suffered ill effects, despite being exposed to exactly the same radiation everyone else was. Each of the officers who had accompanied Fushida to investigate the destruction of Hiroshima showed strange signs of illness. One by one, they died through what now we know to be radiation poisoning, but they didn't know that then. As Fushida returned to Kashiwahara, where he'd been brought up, to help his wife raise the children and to become now a farmer, he was depressed. Life had no taste or meaning. I'd missed death so many times. And for what? What did it all mean? After war, Fushida was called to testify at the trials of Japanese military leaders. When General Douglas MacArthur summoned Fushida to testify in the Tokyo war crime trials, Captain Fushida was disgusted and declared everyone should know that war is war and the cruel acts that occurred on both sides. But these were victor's justice. The General Tojo, who was the Prime Minister of Japan during the war, was put on trial for his life and was hung, not even given a soldier's death of firing squad, which he had requested. The petty vindictiveness of the Allies infuriated Matsuo Fushida, and he denounced the victor's justice. In 1947, he met his former flight engineer, Kazuo Kenegasi, who he thought had died in the Battle of Midway, but had been taken prisoner. Kenegasi reported that a young Christian woman, Peggy Covell, had cared for them in the prison camps, despite her missionary parents having been killed by Japanese soldiers on the island of Panay in the Philippines. Peggy Covell's parents were missionary teachers in Japan until 1939. They then relocated to the Philippines because there was a lot of anger brewing against America's, their policies, so they thought it was better to get out of the country. So they were in the Philippines in 1941 when they were invaded. The Japanese had beheaded both of Peggy's parents on Sunday morning, 19th December 1943. To Fushida, this love for one's enemies was inexplicable because in the Bushido code, the samurai code, it required revenge against the murder of one's parents to restore honor. So he became obsessed to try to understand why anyone would treat the enemies with kindness and forgiveness, which is against his war code. The extraordinary example of Peggy Covell and Jacob de Chazza inspired Fushida to know more about the God of the Christians. When Japanese prisoners of war asked the 18-year-old Peggy Covell why she volunteered to help them, her reply was, "Because Japanese soldiers killed my parents." When Peggy considered her parents' sacrificial service for the kingdom of God and their love for Japanese people, she is convinced she must continue their mission by seeking to reach Japanese for Christ. As Fushida researched from every source in the Philippines that knew the Covells, he learned they'd been forced to their knees by the captives. They'd prayed together as they were about to be beheaded, and they had prayed for the Japanese. They weren't praying for themselves. In 1948, as Fushida was passing by the bronze statue of Hachiko at the Shibuya station, this is this famous loyal dog who every day met his master at the railway station, and when his master died of a heart attack at the college where he's lecturing in town, and he didn't return, this dog waited there for years. He was there every night at the same time to wait for him, and he died there. So they built a statue for him. He was handed a pamphlet about the life of Jacob de Chazza, a member of the Doolittle Raid, who was captured when his B-25 bomber ran out of fuel in occupied China, the Doolittle Raid. In the pamphlet, "I was a prisoner of Japan. De Chazza, a former U.S. Air Force staff officer and a bombardier, related his testimony of imprisonment, torture, and awakening to God. Jacob DeShazer was the bombardier of the B-25 No. 16, and after taking off from the USS Hornet, which, in the Pearl Harbor film, they have fighter pilots, suddenly being converted to fly bombers off an aircraft carrier. For goodness sakes, that is impossible. I suppose the movie wanted to kind of have a continuity, but you don't get fighter pilots being transferred to bomber. It's totally different. Fighters and bombers are not the same. It's just like in the Four Feathers, where suddenly you have cavalry officers becoming Camel Corps and then commanding infantry. Doesn't happen. I mean, it's just absolutely beyond comprehension. But anyway, so Jacob DeShazer was a bombardier in a bomber plane. He flew the bomber planes off. But, of course, in the Pearl Harbor film, they have a bunch of fighter pilots suddenly recruited to fly bombers off an aircraft carrier. Like, you can just make that conversion within a few moments. They flew to China, ran out of fuel over Japanese-controlled China. Now, this is this classic first time ever that twin-engined bombers were flown off aircraft carrier, but they needed the extra fuel to be able to bomb Japan as a retaliation for Pearl Harbor. Specific order from Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He wanted a symbolic attack. He knew that there wasn't enough fuel for these poor people to return. They couldn't return. They just had to fly into China, and, well, most of them would be captured anyway. But Roosevelt made his point that he wanted to make. And so the Doolittle raid was basically a suicide bombing raid, because there was no way back. They couldn't be recovered. Nobody, you might be able to take these planes off, but you could never land them on the aircraft carrier. So there's nowhere to go except China. And most of China was basically, if it wasn't in the hands of communists, in the hands of Japanese, neither of which would have been a happy conclusion. So this was quite an operation, and it surprised the Japanese. It didn't do that much damage, but it was more of a morale propaganda benefit. So brave men doing this, and here you can see Lieutenant Colonel Doolittle. Remember him, because later you'll see Mitsuo Fushida with him, aboard the USS Hornet, April 1942. This is the American counterattack. Yeah, not many planes, but still, it made a point. And so you can see the Hornet launches, they bomb Japan, and they go and land in China. There's nowhere else to go. And these are some of the men in China afterwards, the few that escaped imprisonment. But DeShazer and his crew were captured after parachuting to the ground. DeShazer was imprisoned for 40 months. 34 of these months in solitary confines, he is beaten, malnourished. He saw three of his crew executed by firing squad. The fourth member, Lieutenant Bob Meadow, died of starvation. But after 25 months of hating his captors, a Bible came into his hands for only 3 weeks, but it changed his life completely. He began to learn Japanese and to treat his captors with respect. He resolved to bring the message of Christ to Japan. And after returning to the USA, DeShazer attended Seattle Pacific College and returned to Japan to preach the gospel. After 40 months as captives, three of the four surviving American prisoners noticeably emaciated. Here you can see the pictures. Arrived at Changking, China, late August 1945. Jake DeShazer on the far left. And here's DeShazer, now missionary, preaching in Japan. In fact, he went back and preached in the very towns he bombed. He established a church in Nagoya, the very city it bombed years before. Now, Fushida became intrigued with the Christian faith. The shocking examples of Christians able to forgive their enemies staggered Fushida. That's when I met Jesus. Looking back, I can see now that the Lord had laid his hand upon me, so that I might serve him. Fushida read a tract on the spot right by the statue of this courageous, loyal dog. And on the train, he saw an advertisement for a book with the same title. This book, The Amazing Story of DeShazer, of course, in Japanese. He headed for a bookstore and he purchased it. DeShazer's story engrossed Fushida. He's also an airman. He could relate. Determined to understand what had motivated DeShazer, he bought a Bible from a Japanese man on the street at the same Shibuya station where he had received the pamphlet by that statue of the dog. 1949, he purchased that Bible. And as he read the gospel, he came to understand the reason for the life of forgiveness and mercy that had motivated both Peggy Covell and Jacob DeShazer. When he read, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing," Fushida realized this was what the Covells had been praying before their execution. It was the crucifixion of Jesus, and his words in the gospel, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they're doing." It was on the 14th of April, 1950, that he surrendered to Jesus Christ as his Lord and Savior. By the time he had completed reading the Gospel of Luke, he had become a Christian. He knew no Christians, but now he began to declare himself to be a Christian. He didn't know of any other Japanese Christians. As Christianity was considered the occupation religion in Japan, it was considered a disgrace to his former family and friends, who regarded him as a reproach. "You've accepted the enemy's religion." Peach and Glenn Wagner of the Pocket Testament League of Japan met with Fushida and encouraged him to join them in an open-air preaching. Here is an open-air preaching in Japan. In the business sector of Osaka, as the Americans stood to speak, fewer than 40 Japanese would stop to listen. But when Fushida, the hero of Pearl Harbor, was introduced, the crowd swelled rapidly. Rush hour traffic stopped, hundreds gathered, even the police listened in. This is the beginning of Fushida's new career as an evangelist. Soon he filled an auditorium in Osaka. 500 Japanese came forward at that rally. And every newspaper in Japan reported it. He described his conversion as like having the sun rise, which of course is, that's the symbol of their flag. He preached against Japanese egocentrism and xenophobia. Like Paul on Mars Hill, he used Japanese cultural examples to communicate the gospel of Christ. Captain Fushida went from being a vital part of Japan's military attack in the United States to being a vital part of God's missionary offensive into the hearts, minds, and souls of Japanese, and later Americans and Europeans too. In May 1950, Fushida and Deshaza met for the first time. Jacob Deshaza and Captain Fushida in Japan. He knocked on his door and said, "I've desired to meet you, Mr. Deshaza. My name is Mitsuo Fushida." And Deshaza recognized the name immediately and said, "Come in, come in." And the former enemies embraced as brothers in Christ. Lifelong friends for then on. Deshaza and Fushida, they described one another as best friends. In 1951, Fushida published an account of the Battle of Midway. In 1952, it toured the United States as a member of the Worldwide Christian Missionary Army of Sky Pilots. Sounds like an interesting operation. I remember the thrill that was mine when in one of my first meetings I led my first soul to Christ in America. And he was one of my own countrymen. And here, being welcomed to the United States. Fushida in the middle there. Mitsuo Fushida and Admiral Harp, Chief Chaplain of the U.S. Navy, Reverend Sachs of the Sky Pilots of America. And here's Lieutenant Colonel Doolittle congratulating him on his meeting and greeting his former enemy. Doolittle, who bombed Japan in 1942, Fushida bombed Hawaii in 1941. How could this happen outside of Christ? Cliff Barrows, song leader of the Billy Graham evangelistic team, meeting Captain Fushida. George Wilson of Youth for Christ presenting him with the Billy Graham Bible. Even Billy Graham, who's a tall man anyway, receiving him in 1942. This is an interesting... this is his signature in Japanese with the scripture. In February 1954, Reader's Digest published Fushida's story of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And Fushida wrote, "From Pearl Harbor to Golgotha," later renamed "From Pearl Harbor to Calvary," which we actually have in our shop. In 1955, expansion of his book, Midway, The Battle That Doomed Japan, The Japanese Navy Story, his autobiography, For That One Day, the Memoirs of Mitsuo Fushida, Commander of the Attack on Pearl Harbor, was published in Japan 2007, translated into English, published in 2011. There's a lot more to his life than what I've mentioned. He was crash-landed in Borneo, walked for days in the jungle, and after 3 days walking in the jungle, every night tying themselves in trees to keep away from animals, they came back to a shot down plane and saw, oh, it's our plane. They've been walking in circles for the first 3 days. They just about all lay down on the ground and lost all hope of anything. And but how they finally found their way out, and so many different experiences that this man went through. It's said that the reason for a state to nurture its soldiers for years is to use them for just one day. My entire youth was dedicated for that one day. All his training, all the character development, discipline, so on, focus for that one day, the day of battle. In Midway, the battle that doomed Japan, Fushida wrote, 5 minutes. Who would have believed that the tide of battle would shift in that brief interval of time? And if you know how it went, the backwards and forwards, this is the first battle where navies, where they never saw one of them. The ships were never in sight of one another. It was all fought by aircraft. And just the coincidences and the amount of extraordinary things that happened. You'd have to see the film Midway to kind of understand how it was by a thread. There was just, the Japanese had more aircraft carriers, they had more planes, and they had more experienced pilots. But their one plane, spotter plane that went out, that sighted the American fleet that was waiting to ambush them, because the Americans, of course, knew their plans ahead of time, their radio wasn't working. So they weren't able to alert the... The Japanese made some key tactical decisions which shifted against them. And at a key point, one after the other of the American torpedo planes, dive bombers and others came one after the other, and they were all shot down, every one of them. They lost fleets of their aircraft, squadrons attacked the ships. And at a key point, when the Japanese had sunk one of the American ships, or they thought they had, actually it was only partly sunk, and seriously damaged. And they thought they had gotten all American planes that attacked them, but all their planes were down on the ground chasing others, but their combat air patrol over. They were all down. At that point, one more American dive bomber squadron came in, the last. And there was no Japanese combat air patrol in the air to protect their ships, and all their ships were full of the planes that had just come back from the attack on Midway that were needing to be refueled, and the other ones that had the bombs already to take off for an attack on Midway, and were all stuck on the aircraft carriers at the same time, and then in came the dive bomber squadron. They were caught flat-footed at a key moment. We have been caught flat-footed in the most vulnerable position possible, decks loaded with planes, armed and fueled for attack. And the Battle of Midway could have gone the other way so easily. But the Japanese lost 4 aircraft carriers. And incredibly, Fushida survived, even in a doomed aircraft carrier that was sunk. And he still survived. Fushida turned down an offer from the Japanese government to organize the new Air Force. He faced down an angry pilot who pulled a knife and threatened to kill him, although that man later came to Christ. Here is at Pearl Harbor 1966, pointing to where he led the Japanese planes. He ministered in prisons. He led people to Christ, even in cells of condemned prisoners. He formed Calvary clubs in prisons. Mashiach Fushida related the testimony of Peggy Covell and her brave parents all over Japan. He quoted a testimony, "But the Holy Spirit has washed away my hatred and has replaced it with love." The Covells had gone to death singing hymns joyfully and praying for the conversion of enemies. The blood of the martyrs is a seed of the church, and Mashiach Fushida was one of the fruit of their faith, of the Covell's faith. Fushida spent the rest of his life as an evangelist, taking the gospel of Christ throughout Japan, the United States, America, and Europe. You can actually even Google and get some videos of him being interviewed on American TV. You might have seen the film Torah, 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 which is the most accurate Pearl Harbor film. It's painstakingly accurate with the testimony that were given. Of course, they weren't allowed to use the details that we knew all the codes ahead of time that much, but they allude to it. His testimony for that one day, and there's a whole range of interesting books on it. And this, I've actually got the, this came in one of our shipments. This is one of the original ones, and this is the new reprint, which we've got in the bookshop. But there's a lot more pictures in this one. I've shown the pictures from this in this presentation. From Pearl Harbor to Calvary. We should pray for Japan. In fact, I did this study a few years ago, in 2015, because my son Calvin was in the Scouts, and they were going for their Jamboree, which is only every 4 years, a major, major event with all the scouts around the world get together, and you only get one chance as a scout to go to a Jamboree. And This was Calvin's chance. It was going to be in Japan. And I got suspicious about the time because why was it in August? And I knew immediately, oh, it's 70th anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And I was angry because I thought, oh, they're going to use them for some anti-American propaganda and so on and so forth. So I decided to investigate into, you know, bombing on Pearl Harbor, which I'd always assumed was totally essential to end the Second World War and so on. That I believed that propaganda. And when I studied it, found that every single American military leader at the time, including General MacArthur, said it totally wasn't necessary and it was in fact a war crime and unacceptable and so on. And came to the conclusion, as Herbert Hoover puts too, that the atom bombs were not dropped on Japan to end the Second World War, but to start the Cold War. Because the Second World War was coming to an end. The Japanese wanted to end it months before. But it was essential to start a new paranoia that would justify even more war spending, even when the war's over. And these military-industrial complex criminals and banksters made even more money out of the Cold War than they made out of the First and Second World War combined. And that the atom bombs had a different purpose. Well, in doing more investigation, found out Toshida's testimony and made it into a tract, which we've got in the hallway, for my son to take to Japan when he went on the outreach there and to distribute to the other scouts something significant about Japan. And that's where that testimony came from. And then going a bit further into Herbert Hoover's book, I realized, goodness me, but even this whole Pearl Harbor attack, this day of infamy, this treacherous backstab was complete fabrication and propaganda. There's a lot of books that have been absorbed into these presentations, but these are just some of the research that's out there. There's a huge amount. In fact, I was interested just the other night to listen to the testimony of Admiral Kimmel's grandson, speaking on Andrew Carrington Hitchcock's radio program. And Admiral Kimmel's grandson speaking about that he had heard from his dad, his grandfather. He had got the whole story from him and how he himself has entered the Navy too and was friends with General Short's grandson as well, who'd also entered the Army, and how determined they were to clear their grandparents' name. And all the investigation that exposed this treachery of the U.S. government and the FDR. So, in fact, I think real history is far more fascinating than the propaganda and the garbage that we get dished up in Hollywood. So, any questions? Any comments?
So, you mentioned that after the First World War, the Americans had cleared out all the leftists. But then Second World War, boom, they're back again.
What happened? Wall Street crash. The Wall Street crash, 1929. What happens is whenever there's an economic crash, whatever government's in power is going to lose the next election. Doesn't matter what. And that's always the way it works. Well, except in Zimbabwe. I mean, where there's real elections. Herbert Hoover was elected President of the United States of America in 1928. But in those days, you became President in March the next year. It took longer around the country, of course, communications. So he was elected in 1928. March 1929, he's President of the United States. Wall Street crash happens in the week he becomes President. Of course, it gets blamed on him because, I mean, how can you be to blame if you just came into the office that day? Besides which, presidents don't actually choose economies. Economic movements is by forces outside of any president's hands. Well, unless you Ramaphosa and want expropriation without compensation or like Mugabe. But normally it's outside. Certainly a free president wouldn't interfere with the way an economy works. But still, he was destroyed by that. And the media was. This was all part of a campaign to get the Republicans out, get Democrats back in. Of course, Democrats always get you into another war. And there's no better way to run up debt and to distract people than through war. So that's what changed. The Americans, you've got to remember your lesson because, for example, you just think, you can remember it, September the 11th, 2001, after the World Trade Center. What was it? Well, Islam's finished now. I mean, Americans are really going to have backlash. But within just 8 years? You had Obama in? 7 years. Barack Hussein Obama, a covert Muslim, gets into the White House and makes America the biggest laughing stock and disgrace in the whole world. Destroys Christianity in the Middle East in so many ways, causes havoc, bringing down Libya, trying to stop this war in Syria, and all the hideous things, the chaos in Egypt. So in 7 years, the Americans went from being, well, Islam's the greatest threat to world peace, to being, we've got to have one in the White House. So, unfortunately, people's memories are a bit slow, but also, of course, the media's to blame. And but the Wall Street crash was so disastrous, and people are so, tens of millions lost their homes, lost their farms, lost everything. And that in that situation, that's when social engineers can do their work. Chaos. And it took a lifetime of study for Herbert Hoover to work out what on earth happened and why. So, I mean, that's the backstory.
And you also wasn't a career politician,
right? No, not even close. Yeah. He, in fact, spent his life saving people. He is a great humanitarian. He won Nobel Prizes for this. He is credited with saving the people of Belgium in the First World War, getting the people in Finland spared when Finland was being attacked by the Soviets. He is mobilizing humanitarian aid. So he's the great humanitarian. He's the son of a Quaker. So he came from a pacifist background. He wasn't a pacifist, but his family upbringing was very pacifist. But he obviously did not believe in foreign adventurism. You defend your country, you don't attack others. And of course, I mean, when was America attacked? But they sure attacked a lot of other countries. When I go to America, often have people say, you know, the reason why the Muslims hate us is because we're free. That's rubbish. They hate you because you bomb them. Nobody hates Switzerland. Switzerland's free. They're freer than you. They've been free longer than anyone else. But nobody hates Switzerland because Switzerland minds their own business. And the only thing they do for the rest of the world is the Red Cross and so on. They make nice chocolates and cheese. But, and great watches. Switzerland's free. Nobody hates them for being free. People hate you because you bomb them and sanction them and cause no end of grief. Just mind your own business and pull your soldiers home and maybe people won't hate you so much. But the Americans are absolutely blind to the fact that, well, we've got to be the policemen of the world. Why? Well, you know, there's countries like Iran and North Korea. Yes, well, who made them that way?
So are you going to do a presentation about 9/11 as well? Because it's pretty much exactly the same story.
No jokes. Yeah, well, actually, I don't need to. There's some very good films that have been made on it. Some very, very, very good films. For example, I mean, you just have to look into 9/11 things. For example, you can see aircraft flying, obviously badly, and hitting a telephone pole made of wood. And the telephone pole shaves off the wing. I mean, aluminium does not win a battle against even wood. But now we believe that these aluminium planes just cut straight through reinforced concrete and steel. Steel pillars. You can even just Google what Donald Trump said. He said, I build buildings. And let me tell you, the World Trade Center was really strongly built. They didn't just have the iron on the center, they had it on the exterior. Very, very, very strong. Said no plane could possibly cut through steel pillars and reinforce. He said that's the strongest kind of building possible. It's like, it doesn't matter how fast you fling the butter at the knife will win.
Yeah, actually, I heard in primary school, long before it happened, that's where I learned the World Trade Center buildings were designed to take multiple hits of airplanes.
Yes.
But then when I saw it happen, I saw the buildings fall, and I thought, well, something's not right there.
But the camera never lies.
Well, the camera told a lot of truth. It's just the way it fell. I've just said, that's not a building falling over, that's a building being demolished.
That's imploding.
That's obvious. Yes. Otherwise, it would have just toppled instead of falling on itself.
But you know, the camera never lies. And there's this galaxy far, far away, long, long ago, Star Wars, you know? I mean, you've seen with the eyes, so you know it's true. I mean, it couldn't be fake, could it? Yes, well.
American president deceiving countries to come in. Do they share money or something when they have visited the country to
government? I think it's more than that. Doubtless money's part of it, because of course there's the bankers making a lot of money, there's the military-industrial complex making a lot of money. You can imagine, when everyone minds their own business and gets on with things, it enriches the average person. But when there's wars and chaos, well, then military-industrial complex and the pharmaceutical companies make a mint. And of course the banks who lend the money for people to pay for it, and then the poor taxpayers got to pay for this for the next few generations. Well, they're the suckers. But just think, for example, America's minding its own business in 2001, when World Trade Center was attacked. And, you know, Cold War's over. No, there's only one world superpower. No more nuclear threat. I mean, we can actually get on with business. And there was a moment that was nice. Berlin Wall's fallen. Soviet Union's fallen. Cold War's over. And so everything, actually, there was just a moment of a bit of stability. But when that happened, well, we got to do something. Next thing, they're attacking Afghanistan, then they're attacking Iraq. Now, how many Muslim terrorist attacks were there on America before that? Well, there's been tens of thousands of Muslim terrorist attacks around the world since. That it's like they opened up a hornet's nest. And, of course, this enabled the Muslims to recruit people because America's invading our countries. The Christian crusaders are invading our countries. So you managed to radicalize the people in the Muslim Middle East. And suddenly, where things have been quite stable, like Syria, and Iraq turned into chaos. Libya. Nobody was fleeing from Libya. Libya had a higher standard of living than most other countries. It was a very stable country. But by the destruction of the people, by the millions are fleeing from these countries in Europe, creating tsunamis of chaos and destabilization, a tsunami of refugees, actually. But it ruins the lives of a few million people, destroys many countries, as has been done by decolonization, chaos, and communist revolutions all over Africa. But some people are making amends. And the leaders, well, they get doubtless a lot of kickbacks and benefits, but also they become a war hero. There's a lot of people who think Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a great hero. Of course, I'm not one of them. I'm afraid that these people who've done these things for different reasons, they're obviously, they've benefited somehow. But it's been at the expense of the general population.
And also, doesn't communism have a global agenda?
Like Oh, well, of course. So, I mean, look, America. America was a God-fearing, mostly Protestant country where people were mostly farmers, hardworking mom-and-pop shops and farms. But the Wall Street crash bankrupted so many of these people. Tens of millions of people lost their homes, their farms, their savings, their pensions, their everything. And of course, the 2008 selling of worthless derivatives bubble crashing, that also cost tens of millions of people their homes, their jobs, their pensions, savings, and everything else. And but that's the sort of destabilization they like. You think of how stable Congo used to be, or Rhodesia, and then the chaos caused. And of course, for the people concerned, this is a catastrophe. But for some people up top, they're really benefiting from all this destabilization. And they need to destabilize countries to get away with the nonsense they're doing, because normal people in a normal peaceful situation would not go for that. I mean, you just think how stable was South Africa before the Anglo-Boer War. Why did they do that? Why did they need to have the expropriation of compensation in Zimbabwe? Things were too stable. Chaos is one of the goals of the communists. In fact, remember, if you believe in evolution, evolution leads to revolution, quote unquote, from Stalin. Because there was this big explosion, and out of that came everything. So once upon a time there was nothing, and then there was something, and something became everything. And so, to quote Lenin now, never underestimate the value of constructive chaos. Because they believe everything in the world came about through an explosion. So if you can just burn down enough things and blow up enough things, then utopia will arise. This is social Darwinism. Cultural Marxism. Create chaos, it'll create paradise. If that makes sense to anybody, but if you're on drugs or if you're communist, it'll make sense. Yeah.
I remember one day you were sharing the gospel in Burka with American Daniel De Villiers in the Muslim mosque. Where are you from? I'm from America. The biggest terrorist on the planet has registered on all our countries. So the Muslims. Protestants hate Americans.
And you know, I begin to understand why. Because I used to think that America was totally justified and everyone they bombed. You know, you've got to liberate countries by flying B-52s and dropping tons of bombs on people. This is how you liberate people. But it doesn't make any sense. I mean, why would you want that? If, you know, we want to liberate you in Cape Town. It's 1,000 bomber saturation raids, strategic bombing over this place. And then when you're bombed to pieces and you've lost many of your loved ones and you've lost everything that you had, then now you're free. Oh, thank you so much. You know, I feel so much better now. Like democracy coming soon to a place near you, and here's some cruise missile coming down here. So the Americans, most Americans that I speak to are absolutely convinced that the world would be a terrible place if America wasn't bombing everybody. I mean, they somehow are keeping everything together by just bombing more countries. And I challenge my American friends, tell me one war that the United States has been involved in the 20th century that made the world a better place. Just one. And the only answer I had from one person was, well, maybe President Reagan invading Grenada? Okay, I'll give you Grenada, fair enough. 81 or something? They took Grenada, a little island that the Cubans were turning into a little terrorist place. And okay, so that they improved life in Grenada. Next.
What about their civil war and then the resulting liberating slavery? While
Well, everyone else managed to end slavery without a war.
Yeah.
The British did it years before without anybody having to be killed. Well, except the slave raiders. they made them walk the plank and so on. But nobody died in England from a civil war to end slavery. Everyone ended the slave trade. The whole of Europe ended slavery without a war. So why did America need a war? Well, it wasn't about slavery. It's about state rights. You take, for example, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Sorry. You take, for example, Abraham Lincoln's speech, Gettysburg Address. That government of the people, for the people, of the people, shall not perish. You'd swear that the U.S. Union forces were fighting for self-determination of peoples. But no, that's what the Confederates were fighting for. They were fighting for government of the people, by the people, for the people. His troops, the Bluecoats, they were fighting to take back land that had seceded and declared independence from them. They didn't want people to rule themselves. So the American war between states was not for the principles espoused in the Gettysburg Address. That was propaganda. I mean, that speech was appropriate for the Confederates. It wasn't appropriate for the Yankees. Eh. He was locking up people. He locked up Supreme Court justices. He locked up the entire Maryland legislature because they would want to secede. And so wouldn't let them gather together to secede. He deprived tens of thousands of people of their freedom of movement, freedom of speech, freedom of everything. He banned, blockaded, murdered, hung. The biggest mass hanging in history was done by Abraham Lincoln. There's something, it was 300 and something Indians hung at one time at one place on under his orders. He was not exactly the way they depict him. So, yes, I think our history really needs to be rewritten, and we need a whole new series of films that would... Imagine if you took some of the intrigues that we've mentioned here. It makes some of the intrigues they make in the average films entertaining. Reality is actually more fascinating than any fiction.
Yeah.